Welcome back. This is Manuel Criollo. You're listening to Voices from the Frontlines on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. I'm here with my co-host, Derek Mand. So I'm going to read from the executive summary of this report called African Americans and Climate Change, an Unequal Burden. It says, where U.S. energy policy is concerned, African Americans are proverbial canaries in the mineshaft. We're on the front lines of the likely social, environmental, economic upheavals resulting from climate change. The inadequacy of current U.S. energy policy generates a range of adverse environmental and economic impacts. The report for the Congressional Black Caucus examines the relationship between energy policy, climate change, and the African Americans in order to inform the growing policy discussion. And on the phone today, joining us is Dr. Kenya Cummington and also Michael Gilopter. Michael Gilopter is the Executive Director at Redefining Progress. And Dr. Cummington is with the Black Congressional Caucus Foundation Incorporated. So welcome both.
Thank you. Hello. Very glad to be with you all tonight.
Thank you. So let's start off with Dr. Cummington. Dr. Cummington, there was three main points that that your report talked about. One was the impact, the disproportionate impact that African Americans have as a result of climate change, given sort of deaths through heat waves and the worsening air quality. Second, you know, the main point that the report is talking about is that African Americans are also less responsible for climate change in the United States. And third, that there needs to be policies that will that need to impact climate change, but in fact that need to consider what's going to be the impact on the black community. So can you explore those three points for us?
Ooh, that's a lot. let me first say that we're the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, and we released this report in July, and it was well received by the public. And as you can see, it's still a hot topic. Let me just say that the main issue was that African Americans, we emit 20% less carbon dioxide into the air. However, we are disproportionately burdened through health effects and economic effects. And those health effects are seen in differential rates of asthma in the black community. So African Americans are three times more likely to be affected by upper respiratory problems. And the unfortunate thing is we're 50% less likely to have health insurance coverage that would help address these problems. So lots of times these go unaddressed, which in the long run causes death. So let's see, in terms of economic effects, the problems with climate change and the anomalies in the weather, the patterns of the weather, we see problems with agricultural sector. So where blacks are disproportionately located in southern regions where they rely on the agricultural sector, you can see how that would impact their ability to be employed. So there's a number of problems that climate change causes in our health and in our livelihood. And our ability to be employed, and other sectors. And I'm sure Michael Gilopter, he has some points more technical that he can contribute to the conversation.
Well, Michael, hi, this is Eric Mann.
Hey, Eric.
Glad to have you both on the show. I mean, the first thing is, why don't you tell us a little bit more? Cynthia Rojas and I went to the World Summit on Sustainable Development, and you know that you're going to be attending our conference February 8th, 19th, and 20th in Los Angeles, which we'll tell our listeners about, called The Future of Transportation. And Anja Miller from your group is going to be introducing a film called Rising Waters about the impact of global warming on the small island states. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the impact, the specific health impacts in inner city communities of global warming and greenhouse gases.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having us, and I really appreciate your eulogy of Aussie. You know, we actually have a little bit of an update from the Black Caucus study that we did for the state of California and the California Air Resources Board. It's really alarming. We were able to, for the first time ever, look at the impact of heat deaths, of heat changes, on communities of color in Los Angeles, the only city this has ever been done for. The results are about to come out, but they're in executive summary, so I can tell you a little bit about them now. At the upper end of projections of climate change, heat deaths in the African American community are expected to rise 16-fold between now and 2090, 16 times increase. Across all ethnic groups, again, at the high end of projections for climate change, not the absolute high end, but the 90th percentile, we estimate there will be over 2,000 additional heat deaths per year in Los Angeles alone. I think that's got to be higher than your present murder rate, right?
Yeah.
So it's a different kind of murder, and it's murder by transportation. And, you know, these are the kinds of issues cities have to take really seriously. It affects every ethnic group. Interestingly enough, the folks who are least affected is the Latino community, but that means they only have an 8-fold increase in heat deaths. Whites face a 9-fold increase. Asian Americans face about a 12-fold increase. Again, at the higher end, but at the lower end, you're looking at increases of anywhere from 1.5 to 4 times higher rates, and too many people today already die from heat deaths in Los Angeles. Some of the other health impacts have to do with ozone exposure, air pollution exposure, toxics exposure, all of which are aggravated by heat incidents and by hot weather. Unfortunately, you can't project as accurately what those impacts are going to be, even though they're likely to swamp the heat effects. They're just a little too fine-grained for projecting 90 years out. And they also are likely, particularly the disease outcomes, because you're going to see things like dengue and malaria and stuff moving into the L.A. basin. You already see West Nile virus. Those are harder to project as well because it's anticipated there'll be a public health response. But that public health response is also likely to disproportionately neglect oppressed communities. So, you know, it's a wide range of things. It's hard to make these kinds of projections 90 years out. Heat, we're pretty sure of. It's been reviewed by the National Academy of Sciences as a good methodology, and we're trying to apply it to other cities in California and around the country. But for now, the numbers that we do have are really alarming.
Well, at our conference, which is, again, for the listeners, is we're now well over 300 people confirmed, and we have maybe 25 or 30 seats left for the Saturday and Sunday events. If you're interested in this conference, you can call 213-387-2800 during our show, and people will help you register for it. We're going to be demanding doubling the number of buses in Los Angeles from 2,500 to 5,000, demanding that the auto manufacturers double their miles per gallon from 25 miles per gallon to 50. And the most radical concept is reducing the total number of cars on the road from 8 million in L.A., if you can imagine that, with a 10 million person county, to 4 million. And that's going to be done through proposals such as bus-only lanes, auto-free zones inside the city, bus-only days or car-free days. We're having a speaker from Bogota talk about that. The question I want to ask both of you is that one of the things we realize is that even if black people are not 20% less responsible for the emissions, no one is really, quote, responsible for the emissions at the consumer level yet, unless there's a radical consumer movement to get people to understand that responsibility. For instance, on the Super Bowl yesterday, Pepsi Cola had a commercial where P. Diddy was, his car broke down, so he had a ride to some kind of a opening of a show in a Pepsi truck. And then everybody thought a Pepsi truck must be the coolest thing. It's even better than a Hummer. So then it showed everybody trying to get a Pepsi truck and riding down the street because P. Diddy had one. So what are we going to do about changing the attitudes in the most impacted communities about the Hummer, about the SUV, about, hey, if the white people have it, why can't we have it? In the third world, where people have been denied all these, quote, benefits of technology, are we really going to see the black community leading consumers of the Prius at a time when getting an Escalade is the, you know, the coolest thing going for an oppressed person? Both of you could take a shot at that.
That's a great question, and I did see that commercial. So consumer preferences have to be changed and have to be dealt with. We know that the big trucks not only cause problems with emissions, and they are a drain on people's income.
Right.
Additionally, and so there's a number of reasons why it's good for the black community to change or to attempt to change consumer preferences. And we definitely, the Congressional Black Caucus, the members of the Congressional Black Caucus, they are on board with this report. We got a number of support from members of the caucus, and so we are still in the stages of thinking about how to inform our community about the impacts of climate change. And so these are additional steps that we have to take. And at this point, getting the word out is where we are.
Yeah, I got to say, I mean, the kind of work you're describing from the comments, Eric, is exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go kind of for a supply-driven reduction. I mean, there's really a short window in a human being's life where they're craving a Hummer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a 15-year-old can't drive a Hummer. A 30-year-old has to work and has to take care of their family and has to get to work and can't be worrying too much. Fashion fades quickly.
That's right.
But buses and real transportation are necessary to real life. There's a little period in our lives where we're all going to want to be fashionable and be like P. Diddy, and we ain't going to do that much about that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a much, much longer period of our lives when we have to drive for a living to get to work. When we
I think
have to
more
drive
important
to get our kids to school. And we need to change the supply available to the community.
Additionally,
of those vital transportation services.
There's only a fraction of us that could actually afford those kinds of cars.
That's right.
So we're only talking about a small portion. But the other issue is that there's some other important things that families can do, such as energy efficient appliances, and so those make a difference as well.
And again, they're not just about consumer preference; they're about the bottom line. They're about increasing the material wealth that you are not sending overseas in the form of oil, that you're not sending to the power company in the form of your heating bill or your electricity bill, but instead putting into your pocket for, you know, bling bling that counts, like education or, you know, fashionable things that aren't destructive to the environment, whether it's clothing or other things that can be done responsibly in ways that are helpful to the planet.
Well, I think what you'll see at the conference is we're working very heavily on changing the consciousness of the Black and Latino and Asian Pacific Islander communities, because the irony is Barbara Lott Holland, one of our members, came back from the World Summit on Sustainable Development, and after seeing the film Rising Waters, which we're going to show at the conference, about the literal floods taking place in the small island states where they're building 40-foot concrete walls to stop the water from flooding them, and all the water does is break the concrete walls. She went on the buses with people that don't even have cars and said, listen, we got to stop all this stuff about the Hummer and the SUVs and the Escalades. And people said, are you crazy? I mean, why? I'm on the bus, you know. I don't even have a car.
Hello.
And why are you going to black people to ask us when it's the white people that got all this stuff? And she said, because we're the ones who know better. Because we're the ones who are impacted the most. Because our children, we are the moral compass of this country. And people responded well to that and said, I never thought about it like that, you know, because this is more, you're talking like a civil rights organizer. And she said, well, that's what this is all about. So I think the question is, of course, we have to force the companies. We have to, like Fran Pavley has passed, she's going to be at the conference, Assemblywoman Fran Pavley has passed a bill reducing greenhouse gas emissions from autos by the year 2009. And guess what? General Motors has gone to court to try to stop her on the grounds that this is an inappropriate use of state power. So the beat continues, and that's a lot what we're trying to do. She'll, as I said, she'll be at the conference as well. Manuel, you have a question? Or
Yeah, and I mean, the main thing, I do want to sort of explore this question around the impacts of climate change on the South. It seems that one of the interesting things that I saw in the report, that there was sort of a dual life there, because on one level that you talked about the general impacts it had, but then specifically talked about the impacts in the South. I know you had William Jefferson, who's I think he's a representative from Louisiana, talking about, this is not a myth, y'all. You know, I mean, we already seen, you know, in my hometown of New Orleans, you know, they're already seeing floodings they hadn't seen for a while. And also, you even talked about the impacts of on the diaspora, talking about almost like, I believe about $600 million of impact that's having on Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Can you guys go explore some of those questions of, particularly the impacts that's having on the South?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the bottom line is that one of the findings of the study is that climate change is here and climate change is now. You know, we are seeing already globally increases of over a meter in sea height, and over a meter in sea level. This has been the warmest 15-year period in history. And within the United States, you see it in increased heat deaths, the heat incidents that have happened in Chicago and St. Louis that have been well documented, but you see an uptick in the incidents around the country. You look at the incidence of tropical diseases is on the increase. Black farmers are marginalized. Basically, what climate change does right now is increase temperature, but also increase climate uncertainty, weather uncertainty. And to handle uncertainty, you need a little bit of a fat pocketbook. So poor people, low-income farmers, people who are operating at the margins are going to be more put out by extreme heat, by extreme weather events, which are all on the increase, all on the rise. The World Meteorological Organization called last year the most anomalous climate year on record. Well, that's hurting disadvantaged farmers that are eking out subsistence on sub-Saharan Africa, just as much as impacting black farmers in the South, and communities that are in sort of lowlands, cities and country parts all over this United States are facing those on the border and elsewhere, facing these impacts today.
Well, to both of you, let me ask you a question about our friends in the Democratic Party. I mean, right before the election, there was a film called The Day After, right? And it was one of those, you know, it wasn't scientifically real good. And, of course, you know, the white man goes 3,000 miles to find his son in the New York Public Library, you know, blah, blah, blah. It was pretty ridiculous. But it was pretty good, too. I mean, given Hollywood trash, it was at least trash on the good side of the argument about the seriousness of global warming. And then you have John Kerry, who doesn't touch the issue during the whole convention, during the whole campaign. It is serious now. Bush is warning people about a 40-year future shortfall in Social Security, which ain't going to happen, which is a completely contrived myth. But we can't warn people about a 40-year potential catastrophe in this planet that's happening now. So one of the problems I'm asking both of you, and as you know, you identify with the Congressional Black Caucus, of course, and Michael working independently, is what do we do when we have both parties sitting on the issue of global warming? And the Black Congressional Caucus, the Congressional Black Caucus, has always been one of the few voices of reason and decency inside the Congress, but frankly, are often a marginalized minority, racially and politically.
Well, let me just say that's why studies like this are important. This was pretty much the first comprehensive study of its kind, and it was a bold effort. We brought together three entities, the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation, Redefining Progress, and the National Commission on Energy Policy. And so, and we provided a lot of information that people hadn't seen, and definitely hadn't seen such a comprehensive compilation of the effects of climate change. And so this brought to the table a very diverse group of folks that were willing to discuss, not only CBC members, but other House members. And so this is the beginning of a dialogue, which we have to keep going we have to make sure that we keep the dialogue occurring in our communities. And so we're doing our job. And so we hope that by alerting people to the problems, that other folks will want to join in the debate.
Let me just say for the L.A. audience, Eric and Manuel, we don't really see, we think it's critical that there be a resistance in Congress to a regime that's attempting to ignore these critical problems.
Mm-hmm.
But we think the action on climate change is going to be in states and localities in the United States over the next 5 to 10 years. But that's really where the play is. Just like Fran Pavley passed groundbreaking legislation in California, just like over 30 cities in California have signed on to the Kyoto Treaty in principle saying we want to comply, you know, there's a real effort, and I think, and there's an ability within states to take...
Speak up, Michael.
Again?
Speak up a little, we're having on.
Yeah, there's an ability within states to take action and to establish clear mechanisms for controlling greenhouse gases, and we think a number of states are starting to step up to the plate. What's critical for communities of color, though, is to be at the table, because unthinking, blind climate policy driven purely by an environmental agenda, and this is a key finding of the report, is actually some of the most expensive way to do it and some of the most potentially damaging for communities of color. On the other hand, the right policies for communities of color, the policies that put, that not only control pollution, but put dollars and jobs back into our communities. Those policies aren't just good for communities of color, they're good for the whole country because they're the fairest and most efficient policies. But the devil is in the details. The way Los Angeles chooses to implement climate policy, the way California chooses to implement climate policy, can be just and sustainable or can be unjust and dangerous.
Well, Michael, on that note, we look forward to seeing you at the Future of Transportation Conference, February 18th and 19th. At USC David Center. I think we need to put some extreme weather events upside the head of Howard Dean and John Kerry and the rest of the Democrats. And Ms. Covington, thank you so much for the excellent work you've done, and we'll have you on future shows.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back as soon as we can.
In 1914...